Chapter 4 of John Barleycorn, or Alcoholic Memoirs, by Jack London. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 4. My next bout with John Barleycorn occurred when I was 7. This time my imagination was at fault, and I was frightened into the encounter. Still farming, my family had moved to a ranch on the bleak, sad coast of San Mateo County, south of San Francisco. It was a wild, primitive countryside in those days, and often I heard my mother pride herself that we were old American stock and not immigrant Irish and Italians like our neighbors. In all our section, there was only one other old American family. One Sunday morning found me, how or why, I cannot now remember, at the Morrissey Ranch. A number of young people had gathered there from the nearer ranches. Besides, the oldsters had been there drinking since early dawn, and some of them since the night before. The Morrisseys were a huge breed, and there were many strapping great sons and uncles, heavy-booted, big-fisted, rough-voiced. Suddenly, there were screams from the girls and cries of, "Fight!" There was a rush. Men hurled themselves out of the kitchen. Two giants, flush-faced, with graying hair, were locked in each other's arms. One was Black Matt, who everybody said had killed two men in his time. The women screamed softly, crossed themselves, or prayed brokenly, hiding their eyes and peeping through their fingers. But not I. It is a fair presumption that I was the most interested spectator. Maybe I would see that wonderful thing, a man killed. Anyway, I would see a man fight. Great was my disappointment. Black Matt and Tom Morrissey merely held on to each other and lifted their clumsy booted feet in what seemed a grotesque, elephantine dance. They were too drunk to fight. Then the peacemakers got hold of them and led them back to cement the new friendship in the kitchen. Soon they were all talking at once, rumbling and roaring, as big-chested open-air men will, when whiskey has whipped their taciturnity. And I, a little shaver of 7, my heart in my mouth, my trembling body strung tense as a deer's on the verge of flight, peered wonderingly in at the open door and learned more of the strangeness of men. And I marveled at Black Matt and Tom Morrissey sprawled over the table, arms about each other's necks, weeping lovingly. The kitchen drinking continued, and the girls outside grew timorous. They knew the drink game, and all were certain that something terrible was going to happen. They protested that they did not wish to be there when it happened, and someone suggested going to a big Italian rancho 4 miles away where they could get up a dance. Immediately they paired off, lad and lassie, and started down the sandy road. And each lad walked with his sweetheart. Trust a child of 7 to listen and to know the love affairs of his countryside. And behold, I, too, was a lad with a lassie. A little Irish girl of my own age had been paired off with me. We were the only children in this spontaneous affair. Perhaps the oldest couple might have been 20. There were chits of girls, quite grown up, of 14 and 16, walking with their fellows. But we were uniquely young, this little Irish girl and I, and we walked hand in hand, and sometimes, under the tutelage of our elders, with my arm around her waist. Only that wasn't comfortable. And I was very proud, on that bright Sunday morning, going down the long, bleak road among the sand hills, I, too, had my girl and was a little man. The Italian rancho was a bachelor establishment. Our visit was hailed with delight. The red wine was poured in tumblers for all, and the long dining room was partly cleared for dancing. And the young fellows drank and danced with the girls to the strains of an accordion. To me, that music was divine. I had never heard anything so glorious. The young Italian who furnished it would even get up and dance, his arms round his girl, playing the accordion behind her back. All of which was very wonderful for me, who did not dance, but who sat at a table and gazed wide-eyed at the amazingness of life. I was only a little lad, and there was so much of life for me to learn. As the time passed, the Irish lads began helping themselves to the wine, and jollity and high spirits reigned. I noted that some of them staggered and fell down in the dances, and that one had gone to sleep in a corner. Also, some of the girls were complaining and wanting to leave, and others of the girls were utterly complacent, willing for anything to happen. When our Italian host had offered me wine in a general sort of way, I had declined. My beer experience had been enough for me, and I had no inclination to traffic further in the stuff or in anything related to it. Unfortunately, one young Italian, Peter, an impish soul, seeing me sitting solitary, stirred by a whim of the moment, half filled a tumbler with wine and passed it to me. He was sitting across the table from me. I declined. His face grew stern, and he insistently proffered the wine. And then terror descended upon me, a terror which I must explain. My mother had theories. First, she steadfastly maintained that brunettes and all the tribe of dark-eyed humans were deceitful. Needless to say, my mother was a blonde. Next, she was convinced that the dark-eyed Latin races were profoundly murderous. Again and again, drinking in the strangeness and the fearsomeness of the world from her lips, I had heard her state that if one offended an Italian, no matter how slightly and unintentionally, he was certain to retaliate by stabbing one in the back. That was her particular phrase, "stab you in the back." Now, although I had been eager to see Black Matt kill Tom Morrissey that morning, I did not care to furnish to the dancers the spectacle of a knife sticking in my back. I had not yet learned to distinguish between facts and theories. My faith was implicit in my mother's exposition of the Italian character. Besides, I had some glimmering inkling of the sacredness of hospitality. Here was a treacherous, sensitive, murderous Italian offering me hospitality. I had been taught to believe that if I offended him, he would strike at me with a knife precisely as a horse kicked out when one got too close to its heels and worried it. Then, too, this Italian, Peter, had those terrible black eyes I had heard my mother talk about. They were eyes different from the eyes I knew, from the blues and grays and hazels of my own family, from the pale and genial blues of the Irish. Perhaps Peter had had a few drinks. At any rate, his eyes were brilliantly black and sparkling with devilry. They were the mysterious, the unknown, and who was I, a seven-year-old, to analyze them and know their prankishness? In them I visioned sudden death, and I declined the wine half-heartedly. The expression in his eyes changed. They grew stern and imperious as he shoved the tumbler of wine closer. What could I do? I have faced real death since in my life, but never have I known the fear of death as I knew it then. I put the glass to my lips, and Peter's eyes relented. I knew he would not kill me just then. That was a relief. But the wine was not. It was cheap, new wine, bitter and sour, made of the leavings and scrapings of the vineyards and the vats, and it tasted far worse than beer. There is only one way to take medicine, and that is to take it. And that's the way I took that wine. I threw my head back and gulped it down. I had to gulp again and hold the poison down, for poison it was to any child's tissues and membranes. Looking back now, I can realize that Peter was astounded. He half filled a second tumbler and shoved it across the table. Frozen with fear, in despair at the fate which had befallen me, I gulped the second glass down like the first. This was too much for Peter. He must share the infant prodigy he had discovered. He called Dominic, a young, moustached Italian, to see the light. This time it was a full tumbler that was given me. One will do anything to live. I gripped myself, mastered the qualms that rose in my throat, and downed the stuff. Dominic had never seen an infant of such heroic caliber. Twice again he refilled that tumbler, each time to the brim, and watched it disappear down my throat. By this time my exploits were attracting attention. Middle-aged Italian laborers, old country peasants who did not talk English and who could not dance with the Irish girls, surrounded me. They were swarthy and wild-looking. They wore belts and red shirts, and I knew they carried knives, and they ringed me round like a pirate chorus. And Peter and Dominic made me show off for them. Had I lacked imagination, had I been stupid, had I been stubbornly mulish in having my own way, I should never have got in this pickle. And the lads and lassies were dancing, and there was no one to save me from my fate. How much I drank, I do not know. My memory of it is an age-long suffering of fear in the midst of a murderous crew, and of an infinite number of glasses of red wine passing across the bare boards of a wine-drenched table and going down my burning throat. Bad as the wine was, a knife in the back was worse, and I must survive at any cost. Looking back with the drinker's knowledge, I know now why I did not collapse stupefied upon the table. As I have said, I was frozen. I was paralyzed with fear. The only movement I made was to convey that never-ending procession of glasses to my lips. I was a poised and motionless receptacle for all the quantity of wine. It lay inert in my fear-inert stomach. I was too frightened even for my stomach to turn. So all that Italian crew looked on and marveled at the infant phenomenon that downed wine with the sang-froid of an automaton. It is not in the spirit of braggadocio that I dare to assert they had never seen anything like it. The time came to go. The tipsy antics of the lads had led a majority of the sober-minded lassies to compel a departure. I found myself at the door beside my little maiden. She had not had my experience, so she was sober. She was fascinated by the titubations of the lads who strove to walk beside their girls, and began to mimic them. I thought this a great game, and I, too, began to stagger tipsily. But she had no wine to stir up, while my movements quickly set the fumes rising to my head. Even at the start, I was more realistic than she. In several minutes, I was astonishing myself. I saw one lad, after reeling half a dozen steps, pause at the side of the road, gravely peer into the ditch, and gravely, and after apparent deep thought, fall into it. To me, this was excruciatingly funny. I staggered to the edge of the ditch, fully intending to stop on the edge. I came to myself in the ditch, in process of being hauled out by several anxious-faced girls. I didn't care to play at being drunk anymore. There was no more fun in me. My eyes were beginning to swim, and with wide-open mouth, I panted for air. A girl led me by the hand on either side, but my legs were leaden. The alcohol I had drunk was striking my heart and brain like a club. Had I been a weakling of a child, I am confident that it would have killed me. As it was, I know I was nearer death than any of the scared girls dreamed. I could hear them bickering among themselves as to whose fault it was. Some were weeping for themselves, for me, and for the disgraceful way their lads had behaved. But I was not interested. I was suffocating, and I wanted air. To move was agony. It made me pant harder. Yet those girls persisted in making me walk, and it was 4 miles home. 4 miles! I remember my swimming eyes saw a small bridge across the road an infinite distance away. In fact, it was not 100 feet distant. When I reached it, I sank down and lay on my back panting. The girls tried to lift me, but I was helpless and suffocating. Their cries of alarm brought Larry, a drunken youth of 17, who proceeded to resuscitate me by jumping on my chest. Dimly I remember this, and the squalling of the girls as they struggled with him and dragged him away. And then I knew nothing. though I learned afterward that Larry wound up under the bridge and spent the night there. When I came to, it was dark. I had been carried unconscious for 4 miles and had been put to bed. I was a sick child, and despite the terrible strain on my heart and tissues, I continually relapsed into the madness of delirium. All the contents of the terrible and horrible in my child's mind spilled out. The most frightful visions were realities to me. I saw murders committed, and I was pursued by murderers. I screamed and raved and fought. My sufferings were prodigious. Emerging from such delirium, I would hear my mother's voice, "But the child's brain, he will lose his reason." And sinking back into delirium, I would take the idea with me and be immured in madhouses and be beaten by keepers and surrounded by screeching lunatics. One thing that had strongly impressed my young mind was the talk of my elders about the dens of iniquity in San Francisco's Chinatown. In my delirium, I wandered deep beneath the ground through a thousand of these dens, and behind locked doors of iron, I suffered and died a thousand deaths. And when I would come upon my father, seated at a table in these subterranean crypts, gambling with Chinese for great stakes of gold, all my outrage gave vent in the vilest cursing. I would rise in bed, struggling against the detaining hands, and curse my father till the rafters rang. All the inconceivable filth a child running at large in a primitive countryside may hear men utter was mine. And though I had never dared to utter such thoughts, they now poured from me at the top of my lungs as I cursed my father sitting there underground and gambling with long-haired, long-nailed Chinamen. It is a wonder that I did not burst my heart or brain that night. A 7-year-old child's arteries and nerve centers are scarcely fitted to endure the terrific paroxysms that convulsed me. No one slept in the thin frame farmhouse that night when John Barleycorn had his will of me. And Larry, under the bridge, had no delirium like mine. I am confident that his sleep was stupefied and dreamless, and that he awoke next day merely to heaviness and moroseness, and that if he lives today, he does not remember that night, so passing was it as an incident. But my brain was seared forever by that experience. Writing now, 30 years afterward, every vision is as distinct, as sharp-cut, every pain as vital and terrible as on that night. I was sick for days afterwards, and I needed none of my mother's injunctions to avoid John Barleycorn in the future. My mother had been dreadfully shocked. She held that I had done wrong, very wrong, and that I had gone contrary to all her teaching. And how was I, who was never allowed to talk back, who lacked the very words with which to express my psychology, how was I to tell my mother that it was her teaching that was directly responsible for my drunkenness? had it not been for her theories about dark eyes and Italian character, I should never have wet my lips with the sour, bitter wine. And not until man grown did I tell her the true inwardness of that disgraceful affair. In those after days of sickness, I was confused on some points and very clear on others. I felt guilty of sin, yet smarted with a sense of injustice. It had not been my fault, yet I had done wrong. But very clear was my resolution never to touch liquor again. No mad dog was ever more afraid of water than I was of alcohol. Yet the point I am making is that this experience, terrible as it was, could not, in the end, deter me from forming John Barleycorn's cheek by jowl acquaintance. All about me, even then, were the forces moving me toward him. In the first place, barring my mother, ever extreme in her views, it seemed to me all the grown-ups looked upon the affair with tolerant eyes. It was a joke. Something funny that had happened. There was no shame attached. Even the lads and lassies giggled and snickered over their part in the affair, narrating with gusto how Larry had jumped on my chest and slept under the bridge, how so-and-so had slept out in the sandhills that night, and what had happened to the other lad who fell in the ditch. As I say, so far as I could see, there was no shame anywhere. It had been something ticklishly, devilishly fine, a bright and gorgeous episode in the monotony of life and labor on that bleak, fog-girt coast. The Irish ranchers twitted me good-naturedly on my exploit and patted me on the back until I felt that I had done something heroic. Peter and Dominic and the other Italians were proud of my drinking prowess. The face of morality was not set against drinking. Besides, everybody drank. There was not a teetotaler in the community. Even the teacher of our little country school, a graying man of 50, gave us vacations on the occasions when he wrestled with John Barleycorn and was thrown. Thus, there was no spiritual deterrence. My loathing for alcohol was purely physiologically. I didn't like the damn stuff. End of chapter 4.